You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode number 123 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcino,
and we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks,
and we are back with the first full week of football for the 2018 season, and we have got a lot of problems with you people.
I mean, after this weekend, definitely a lot of problems with football, I think it's fair to say.
We are going to have tons of football talk. Fortunately, we've retired Mariners hot takes for the season, and I think the Mariners have retired for the season.
Their playoff odds on Fangraphs were under 1% before Tuesday night's 2-1 loss to the lowly San Diego Padres. So we're
going to be down to 0.8%.
We're getting into, so you're telling me there's a chance territory for the Mariners at this point. But even though it is clearly fall now, we're not going to drink a fall beer tonight.
You're hanging on to the summer. I mean, it's technically the summer right now.
It is.
This is the last week that it's summer, pretty much.
There's approximately 10 more days.
This is the week of summer. And that is why we're drinking the Rubens from Ballard, Washington Summer IPA.
And also because of the fact that I happened to get that. We'll toast when we get this open here to my friend Kelly on celebrating her wedding last weekend.
This was stolen from the wedding. This is heisted beer.
Stolen. But congrats to Kelly and Ryan.
Do you know what season it is?
What season is it?
It's fresh hop season.
Oh, do I know it's fresh hop season? I do, because I've already had one.
The Field of Ferment, Fremont Field of Ferment.
Yeah. Loyal listener Nate hooked it up at the tailgate last Saturday, which you did not attend.
Oh, God. Of course he did. Of course he did. I'm impressed.
This is why you shouldn't miss out on tailgates.
Never again.
Yeah, you're definitely never going to miss a tailgate again. Sure, that's going to happen. Look, some of us have the dedication to both attend a wedding and a football game in the same day.
The wedding that I went to, I had to pick up the mic from pouring. The wedding that I went to started at 4 o'clock.
Yes, mine was...
How could I have done that?
Mine was conveniently scheduled at 7 because the couple are Husky fans, and I was definitely not the only person to make the Husky game wedding double on Saturday. In addition to that, we should toast to Seattle's Hall of Famers. We didn't mention this on last week's pod. Last Friday was the induction ceremonies for the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, and so many Seattle ties among the inductees last week. Of course, former Sonics Ray Allen and Rod Thorne, a part of the inaugural Seattle team, were inducted, as well as former Sonics ball boy and front office executive Rick Welts, who went on to a very long career as an executive both at the NBA league office and then team president for first the Suns and then most recently the Warriors. He was a driving force behind bringing the Warriors to Seattle for the preseason game that'll be played here next month in the last event at Key Arena. And then also two former Storm players in Katie Smith and Tina Thompson going into the Hall of Fame. So a toast to all of those basketball legends.
All right. Where do you think Ray Allen ranks among all-time Sonics?
So this was a debate, I don't know if you saw this, that loyal listener Jimmy and I got into last week.
Oh, yeah.
He was lamenting the fact that the Seattle media had not said much of anything about Ray going into the Hall of Fame, which was kind of surprising, but also the Basketball Hall of Fame just isn't that big of a deal. I don't know if it was necessarily a reflection on Ray, but he was declaring him one of the top 20 Seattle athletes ever, and I took issue with that because I don't think he's one of the top 5 all-time Sonics.
Most of your top 20 Seattle athletes are hydroplane drivers.
Look, Japan Hour is definitely one of the top 20 all-time Seattle athletes. There is no question about that. But, I mean, when you look at the fact that he was only here for 4.5 seasons.
It really felt like longer. It was only 4.5 years that he was here?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And the fact that there was only one playoff trip in that span, huh. I think it's hard to put him over the players who have most of the players who have retired jerseys. I mean, he's kind of in there with Spencer Haywood in that same tier. But you look at, you know, someone like Fred Brown, Lenny Wilkins, he's maybe in the same tier as well because Lenny wasn't here that long. But obviously Kemp and Peyton rank ahead of him, Jack Sikma. So I think, you know, the very highest you could place him is probably fourth or fifth. but I don't know if he's one of the top five all-time Sonics. What
about Richard?
He's right, you know, different cases. Obviously, Richard didn't have the peak value, but was here so much longer.
Uh-huh. Detlef?
Yep.
Same thing.
Yeah, I mean, Gus Williams. There's a lot of players that you can make cases for. I mean, that's maybe an exercise we should do someday, but, you know, he's not clearly one of the top five.
Huh. But going to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, because of the fact that he had stints like this in Milwaukee and in Boston, and then won another championship on top of that in Miami, where he had made perhaps the most iconic shot in NBA history. So,
most iconic shot in NBA history, huh?
Yeah.
I'm skeptical about that, but okay.
I mean,
there's the Jordan game
yeah, okay,
six.
Okay, that's probably the most iconic shot.
Call me when Jay-Z starts rapping about that Ray Allen shot.
All right, that's fine, but it doesn't rhyme as well.
That's the only reason that he's not rapping about it.
It is.
I guess that is true, though. Is Ray Allen kind of belongs to a lot of different cities.
Yeah.
Except and Boston hates him. Which makes us like him more, at least me personally.
Okay, fair enough.
Oh, are we toasting them? Did we ever toast them?
I don't know. All right. We can do it again. Do you want to talk about food?
There's a little bit of food news.
Food news. We don't want to step on House of Carbs. But they're not covering Seattle food news necessarily in the detail that we are. So let's just call this a food update.
Okay, so should I do the food news first before the California food reviews?
Again, food update.
Food update. So PeltonCast Instagram, which by the way, you should go follow if you haven't. Tons of good content on there. Amazing content.
Hashtag content.
People are negotiating fantasy football trades in the DMs.
That is.
I was like, what is this? broken to us on the PeltonCast Instagram DMs from our good friends at Bluebird Ice Cream.
Yeah.
Who sent this message, which was pretty amazing. The message from earlier today. You guys probably already know this, which we did not.
Nope.
But just in case, Tacos Chuki's signed a lease for a Central District location next to Chuck's Hop Shop.
That's very exciting news.
Whew! I mean, that is like, if you've got the Chuck's and Tacos Chuki's right there next to each other.
Apparently, this information is out there, by the way.
It was not out there to us.
It wasn't.
There's a liquor license public notice in their window with their name on it.
Yeah. In January, it was revealed to the public that they're going into
last January? Century. We've been unaware of this info for that long?
We have.
Wow, asleep at the wheel.
The entire time that we were choosing Tacos Chuki's is Seattle's best tacos/burritos.
So one of the best experiences about going to that particular Chuck's Hop Shop is that you can get food from the food truck outside or bring in your own food
right.
or whatever and eat it there. And it's a great experience, especially over the summer.
Yeah.
Now, if you could have Tacos Chuki's, I mean, like, there's no better combo in Seattle.
We'll see how long the line is, whether it qualifies as a full-on sneak, but certainly the ability to take Chuki's from there
and take
it to Chuck's Hop Shop.
It's too obvious to be a sneak.
True. Good point.
But, I mean, that is pretty, it's pretty exciting.
It's two great tastes that go great together.
That you can do that together. The thing is, though, you may have to modify the PeltonCast special at that location.
Because of the fact that you're going to take it and not drink the two tecates there?
Yes. So you might have to do two tacos, two burritos, and two drinks at Chuck's Hop Shop of your choosing.
I got to say, when I did have a tecate the most recent time I went because they were out of the Chuki's lager, it was very watery.
Oh!
Very watery.
That's what it's supposed to be like.
I suppose so.
Okay, well, thank you to our good friends at Bluebird Ice Cream for telling us about this.
Bringing this to our attention.
I also wanted to say, I was in LA last week, and I had one goal while I was there. And that was going to Del Taco for the first time ever. I actually asked you if it was crazy of me to go to Del Taco while I was in LA, and you were like, yes, because there's one in Western Washington. And I hypothesized that I've been in Los Angeles more in the last 3 years than I have been in Federal Way, Washington.
It actually does seem to check out when I think about it.
I went there for laser tag like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
But before then, I don't remember any time being in Federal Way. I mean, driving through or whatever, but that doesn't really count.
I once stopped at that Del Taco, like coming back from Portland after a Blazers game.
You ate at Del Taco?
Yeah.
Oh, is that the only time you've been?
No, I went to it once in either Southern California or Las Vegas. I can't remember where.
Okay.
I had been to it before.
Well, I'd never been there before, and I've heard so much about Del Taco, especially from our good friends at Lil Woody's.
Third Pelton brother, Corey.
Corey at Lil Woody's, head of burgers, head of production. I can't remember his job title. I really like the job title, head of burgers.
Executive chef.
Executive chef. There we go. That's basically head of burgers. Yes. So he's a big Del Taco fan. And before I went there, I texted him and I was like, tell me what the Del Taco order is. Like, what should I do? And I'm not going to say that I followed his order, but his text back was so perfect. As the executive chef of Lil Woody's, I felt like I had to read it.
I mean, it would be difficult to follow this order as one person.
Okay. All right, this is from Corey. All right, let me give you the order, which I love how it starts like that. It's just like he's been waiting his whole life to answer this question.
Exactly. Well, I mean, much the same as when people ask us.
Yeah, we're giving out recommendations for food at Tri-Cities.
And another winning recommendation.
First, the Epic Cali Burrito, one red bean burrito and sour cream, one green burrito, add sour cream, large fries, chips and queso dip, grilled chicken soft tacos, and my more recent favorite has been the Epic Chipotle Chicken Burrito. The fries are insane there. And then he responded later, dude, all the sauces are the best. Damn it, I'm driving to Federal Way today. You got me craving Del Taco, which he said he did.
I don't know if that qualifies as worth a full page ad. You're welcome, but it's definitely the Pelton Cast continuing to change lives
by getting him to drive to Del Taco.
Yes,
he is changing my life though by giving me this order.
It's true.
So I tried to follow it as good as I could. I realized that I needed to get loaded fries or whatever, and I needed to get a Cali style burrito.
What style of fries are they?
I think these were crinkle cut.
That's what I kind of was thinking.
Crinkle cut is a pretty good style of fry. I would say
I'm not a big crinkle cut guy.
Really?
Yeah, no.
We need to rank styles of fries later. Look, okay. We don't have time for that now. It's week one of the NFL.
I know the third Pelton brother for that.
Wait, who is it? Is it Nate?
No.
Oh, I was going to say it's Nate Duncan for everything.
No. It's our Talking Taco Bell co-host.
Oh, Eden. Really?
Very into styles of fries.
I told a lot of people that Talking Taco Bell was happening, so we need to actually make that happen.
Okay.
I'll host it if I need to.
Okay.
I'm so excited for the breakfast episode. Anyway, episodes. It'll be a full month on it.
like burger fast food month at Lil Woody's, which We should probably mention. Did we mention that last week?
I don't think so.
It's going on right now. Speaking of Corey and his work as executive chef at Lil Woody's,
you know what, his work for me inspiring him to go to Del Taco, they inspired me to go to Jack in the Box and get a sourdough Jack.
And now to go to Lil Woody's and get the sourdough,
it was too hard to get there. I was driving to your house. Do you remember this when I was like, can we push this interview back with Natalie Weiner, which we did last week, which you should listen to, and we'll update the how things are going in the Storms WNBA finals. I was like, can we push the call back from 4 to 4:15? It was because I was getting a sourdough Jack.
Of course it was.
It's all Corey's fault. Anyway,
yeah.
At Del Taco, so I went with the steak and guac Cali style burrito.
That sounds good.
It was good. I'm a little bit, I have to say, I mean, Taco Time is like clearly the top. It's really not in
the same category?
It's not in competition with these other places, right? Taco Time is like a step higher than everything else. It's good, good, fresh, fresh. Taco Bell to me, a little bit of a Taco Bell stan, right?
That's,
I mean,
fair.
I'm hosting the podcast, I think. I think that Taco Bell was a tier higher than Del Taco.
Interesting.
I was a little bit let down. I mean, this was like the one meal that I felt like I needed to have in LA was Del Taco. And it was just like, it was good.
I'm going to LA next week. I am not going to Del Taco. I hate to break it to you. I mean, I guess I can't rule that out.
Yeah, there's a chance. There's a chance. Don't rule it out.
I don't know if I'm going for like my sixth In-N-Out visit of the year.
I've had enough In-N-Out for a while. I had to take a break from it. It was all Del Taco this time. Anyway, it was good. I was happy that I went. And thank you to Corey for those recommendations.
Yeah, so let us know.
It's like enough food for eight people.
Yeah. Whew. Should we talk about sports?
Let's talk about sports.
Are we going to start with the Seahawks? Or are we going to start with the Storm?
Let's start with the Storm.
The Seattle Storm. One win away from the WNBA championship, having taken a 2-0 lead in the WNBA finals by winning the first two games of this series at home. On Friday night, they cruised to a double-digit victory in game one, leading by 20-plus points heading into the fourth quarter, where Washington made it slightly slightly less lopsided in garbage time with their reserves playing the entire quarter, but still the Storm's cruising. And after that, you were feeling good about your take that the real finals were the semifinals against Phoenix.
Still am.
But Washington's providing a much stiffer test in game two, leading at halftime, and much of the back and forth third quarter heading into the fourth until the Storm came out with a 7-0 run to start the fourth quarter, never trailed again, but never completely pulled away. Washington had the ball down one inside the final 20 seconds with a chance to take the lead and potentially win the game. But Sue Bird, using what she told us after the game, that legendary UConn associate head coach Chris Daly, herself a Hall of Famer, declared the good old Sue Bird move, where she swipes from behind and deflecting the ball away from Washington's Christy Tolliver to force a jump ball won by the Storm. And then that left the Mystics with only 1.8 seconds left on the clock and no timeouts to attempt a desperation 60-footer from Ariel Atkins at the buzzer that did not go in.
Was it close? Was it as close as it seemed?
I don't think so. I was kind of like in line with the basket, but she was off to the side of the court, so I wasn't like following the flight of the ball, but it never seemed to have that good of a chance to me once she released it.
Okay. We were kind of sweating it here.
By contrast, when Sue Bird knocked down that bank three the end of the shot clock in the fourth quarter, what ended up being a very crucial shot in the game, like as soon as she released it, I was like, Sue's going to make that, isn't she? And then she did.
That was pretty epic for Sue to have a signature shot in the finals.
Yeah.
How much of, I don't want to say the Storm's domination in the series, domination in game one, how much of that has to do with Elena Deladon's injury?
She definitely wasn't herself in game one. And the Storm came out with a really good game plan that the Mystics, I don't think, really handled particularly well in game one. So Washington likes to run a lot of pick and roll with Christy Tolliver, their all-star point guard, and Deladon. And the Storm decided to trap a lot of those and take advantage of the fact that they were putting more size on Tolliver, who's an undersized player, with Alicia Clark, who's had a really dominant defensive postseason, first against Diana Taurasi and now against Tolliver. And that, I think, was a big factor in taking her out of her game. But she's also clearly 75 to 80%, I think, at this point. In game two, the Mystics adjusted a little bit. They ran pick and rolls with other bigger players who were more difficult for the Storm to trap. And Deladon did get going, particularly in the second quarter. She had, I think, 12 points in that quarter, which is more than she had in all of game one, but still went scoreless in the fourth quarter as Breanna Stewart kind of dominated that matchup of MVP power forwards.
And how much has she dominated the series in general?
I mean, she's a pretty clear choice for MVP at this point, assuming the Storm go on to win the series. But, she's been the best player.
And what do we expect now as the series moves to the road, Game 3 in the Washington area?
The DMV is what I'm going with.
What are we expecting out of that Game 3? And is the series coming back to Seattle?
So, I mean, the big thing that you have to expect for the Mystics is they're going to shoot better from three. They went 0 of 16 from three-point range in game two, the most attempts without a make.
16?
Yeah, 0 of 16.
And it was that close?
Yeah.
Wow.
The most attempts without a make in a playoff game in WNBA history, a record that previously the Phoenix Mercury threatened against the Storm in game two of that series when they missed their first 14 before hitting their final four, including those back-to-back Diana Taurasi threes that sent that game into overtime.
Are the Storm good at three-point defense?
You should know better than to ask that question.
But I'm saying it's your three-point defense doesn't exist.
Yeah. But they have enjoyed remarkable good fortune in terms of opponent three-point shooting throughout this playoff run. Phoenix way below their season average on threes. And now Washington, in the first two games of this series, shot 8.3% on threes.
Wow. Have teams shot poorly on threes during the regular season vis-a-vis their season average?
I actually am not sure about this, but the fact that I'm not suggests to me that it wasn't something that stood out when I looked at the stats previously. As I pull this up here, the Storm had the third lowest percentage at 33.8. Is compared to a league average of 34.5%. So not really a substantial difference there.
Huh. They've gotten lucky.
Yeah.
And we hope that this luck continues.
I mean, no, again, part of this is Deladon being injured. Tolliver has struggled from three throughout the playoffs. Like, Washington might not be quite as good as usual in terms of their three-point shooting, but, yeah, I mean, they're obviously going to shoot better than 8.3% going back home.
But how many chances will they have? I mean, that's the thing about this. They're not going back home for a guaranteed two games. They're going back home for what could be just one game.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Storm also did not shoot particularly well in game two. It was the kind of game, you know, offensive performance. I wrote about this on ESPN after the game. Like, it was the kind of game that last year they would have lost because they weren't good enough defensively to win a game like this. And now with the addition of Natasha Howard, who's defended Deladon in this series, been the primary defender on her, and just with a greater commitment to defense, and then also rebounding, where they were excellent on the glass in game two, they're able to win games like that. And that certainly boosts your chances going out on the road.
They're able to win ugly.
Yeah. I mean, it was a great
especially
win.
When the other team shoots 0 of 16 from 3.
Especially then, yes.
Still, this is exciting.
It is. Yeah, I mean, you know, their chances of victory have gone way up from the 65% I think I said before the series.
What would you put the chances at now?
Probably between 85 and 90.
All right. Wow.
And it is interesting. I mean, I don't know that this means anything going forward, but all the WNBA finals that have gone 2-0 since they went to best of five have ended up in sweeps.
Really?
Including the Storm in 2010. Who won that in that series? They won three close games against Atlanta, but completed the playoffs at 8-0. And the Storm now have won seven consecutive games in the WNBA Finals. They've only lost once ever in the finals, so they have the best record of any WNBA team there.
In 2004, they lost?
They lost game one and then won the next two, and then have now won seven in a row.
Why don't they do seven games in the finals?
I mean, they have to. I mean, the issue with the WNBA is that you can't have a long season because of the constraints on it. So right now, the World Championships are coming up in Spain basically very soon after the finals. I think it's, you know, potentially less than a week afterwards. Huh. So, you know, that's why they have to get the series wrapped up in a certain amount of time.
All right. Well, I mean, I'm looking forward to game three, and that's happening tonight.
Yep.
As you're hearing this on ESPN2.
Yep.
Is that airing also locally? I think Sunday's game did on Como.
No. That game was on ABC nationally.
Mm.
And then game one, because it was on ESPN News, aired locally on Joe TV. But from here on out, all the remaining games will be on ESPN2.
I just let you go from ESPN News to ABC nationally.
Well, I mean, the ESPN news was because of the fact that the Storm had to push the game from Thursday to Friday because there was an event at Key Arena on Thursday. Uh-huh. So otherwise, it would have been on ESPN, too. That's where
what
it was originally scheduled.
On Thursday?
Was it like some sort of a Game of Thrones concert thing?
Oh, nice.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, that checks out.
It worked out because the tennis match, someone retired, and they were able to play the second game on ESPN. Unfortunately, by that point, the Storm were dominating, so it wasn't really a compelling game to watch. All right, well, now should we talk about the Seahawks?
Yeah.
So because of the fact that I was covering the Storm game on Sunday, the entirety of what I actually saw live of the Seahawks game consisted only of the final Seahawks drive, the ill-fated final Seahawks
You get to
drive.
See that fun drive. So, I guess I'm curious, first off, what your takeaways are from the game and whether it changes any expectations for the season for the Seahawks.
I mean, it felt like it went a lot like we expected it to. I mean, from like a score standpoint, the game was a push because of the fact that it exactly hit the line coming into that game.
Yes.
And, you know, clearly the Seahawks were dominated more in terms of a per-play basis than the final score indicated. like in terms of yardage.
Sure.
And that's in DVOA, if now that Football Outsiders has come out with that, reflects that. But then that's also probably not that surprising given what we expected in terms of the altitude based on what Ben Baldwin said on this podcast last week.
It's very strange, this game.
Was it strange?
Not because it was any different than any Seahawk game ever. It was strange in as much as right after the game with the loss, it was like, this was a game that the Seahawks could have won very easily, right? I mean, they had a lead in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
They had chances with the ball to tie the game. And so after the game was over, I was thinking to myself, like, I feel better about this team than I did before the season. They went into a very tough place to play and played basically even with what may be a pretty good Broncos team.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves just yet. How many interceptions did Case Keenum throw?
He threw three and Russell threw two. I don't know. It's not that big of a difference.
Well, Russell, one of his was on the
Russell,
final
Russell
play
really
of the game.
Threw one. Yeah. But
it only mattered in terms of my fantasy performance.
You stole one, didn't you?
I did.
Okay, quit whining.
And apologies to Natalie for like a terrible loss for her to me. It was totally undeserved.
So I was thinking, like, going into this game, I was feeling pretty down on the Seahawks season and chances. But then after it happened, I was like, this is a close game. I'm excited about it. Whatever. I'm like, oh, maybe this team isn't bad. And then as I started looking at the stats more, I felt much worse about the team going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the difference between the score and the kind of play-by-play.
And basis. When you're physically in it, you're like, this is a game that the Seahawks could have won. And also, it felt like every single Seahawks game ever.
Right.
You know, the difference between, and you could have called it in the second quarter, that the Seahawks were going to be in a position where they were down with the ball at the end of the game, and Russ was going to throw an interception to end the game.
Yeah.
Like, we've seen this over and over and over again. It's happened so many times that we knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's happened against what are probably worse teams in worse situations than going to Denver in the altitude. Not worse situations, in better situations. Right. Right? It's happened at Tampa Bay. It's happened at Indianapolis. What are some more? At San Diego a couple years ago.
At St. Louis.
At St. Louis in the past. I mean, it just feels like this is every single road game that the Seahawks play.
Particularly in the month of September.
But, taking a step back and looking at it, Michael Dixon, A, matters.
Yeah.
B, the Seahawks got those turnovers.
Yep.
C, Doug Baldwin is injured for at least a period of 3 to 4 weeks, minimum.
I mean, Pete Carroll is...
Pete Carroll's optimistic.
Yeah, he's peddling his usual brand of optimism and saying it a couple of weeks at minimum.
And so my kind of excitement about this, and the thing about Michael Dixon is that he's amazing, A. And B, he is so good at punting that it meant that the Broncos were able to accrue 470 yards of total offense and still only win this game by 3 points because there's so much field for them to traverse after these Michael Dixon punts.
Yes.
And if Michael Dixon wasn't there, my outlook for the season would be surprisingly worse. Like, I think it's not as unseen as it may be in other situations how good of a punter he is. But, like, he could mean the difference of a win in a punter.
I guess so. I mean, yeah, I guess that's quite possible. I mean, he was credited, the Seahawks created... according to Pro Football Reference's EPA model, 9.7 expected points on their punts in this game, which was the second highest in the PFR database since 1991 behind Brandon Fields for the 2010 Miami Dolphins. And Dixon was better on a per punt basis than Fields, but Fields punted 10 times in that game.
There you go.
And that was coming from Vincent Verhey's piece on Football Outsiders, The Quick Reads, which was largely devoted to Dixon.
Devoted to punting.
Vince showing his 12 status there. But he pointed out that more perhaps if you go even farther back in NFL history, it was the second most net yards per punt by any punter in a game in NFL history at 57.5 net yards per punt. Behind only Ron Stark had 59.5 for the 1992 Indianapolis Colts.
I mean, we're in like legendary punt status territory.
Yeah.
I mean, look,
he's not always going to be punting.
I don't think the altitude matters that much.
It matters in terms of the length of the punts. But in terms of the downing, you know, pinning teams and downing punts out of bounds, it doesn't.
I think Pete was talking after about, like, he was wondering whether Michael Dixon would do, like, handling the moment or whatever. And it was like, he's handling it just fine. It's like, of course he is. He's a seasoned veteran out there.
He really is the Seahawks' most valuable player.
Easily. It felt like, just in general, like, the line looked relatively similar to what it did last year.
Yeah, I mean, six sacks is not great. Not that all of those are entirely on the line.
The run game looked basically the same as it did last year.
I would push back on that a little bit. The run game with Rashad Penny looked basically the same as it did last year. I guess Chris Carson, most of his yards were on two runs. So he did only have, I think, you know, one positive EPA run, according to Ben.
Well, he had a reception also. He had positive plays and receptions, Chris Carson did, which I don't think Rashad Penny had any of. So the line looked basically the same. There were more mistakes on defense than I think I was anticipating going into the game, and more errors, which it makes sense when you think about it logically why that would happen with a new defense out there with two rookies playing, if not more, tons of players who haven't seen a lot of game action playing.
So, and with Earl Thomas not always being in there.
And did you see the difference that Earl Thomas makes on the field and off the field?
The yards per play?
And the EPA value, too.
Yeah, it's striking.
I mean, like, can you pull that up? Why? So, okay, here's...
Rashad Penny did have four catches for 35 yards in this game. Right, well, I don't know what you're okay, impugning.
All right, fine. Rashad Penny's great.
Don't be too anti-Rashad Penny.
Like, okay.
People are already down enough. People are already saying the Seahawks should have taken Reese Freeman instead of him, which, guys, the point was not that they should have taken a different running back. The point was don't take a running back in the first round at all.
Is that there was one good rookie running back on the field on Sunday, and he was undrafted. Well, I guess Royce Freeman
did play well, too. But yes, that's the better point, that Philip Lindsay looked as good as he did.
There were three good young running backs on the field. One was drafted in the seventh round. One was undrafted, right?
Royce Freeman wasn't drafted in the seventh. Or you're talking about Carson. Oh, I see.
Carson.
I mean, Lindsay did go 15 for 7, or Freeman went 15 for 71 as well.
No, so he's good too, but he was drafted in the second or third round,
right? Yeah. I just said you said there were two good ones. I'm saying there were three.
I said there were three.
Oh, okay.
And I was just saying those were the draft positions of those players. Or not even draft positions.
The undraft positions?
What did you think about the play calling in the game?
I mean, not watching the game, it's tough to analyze it. It seems like a lot of the criticism is they pass too much, and that is almost literally never a thing I would complain about. So I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, no, they passed an appropriate amount of time.
Like, people were upset that they came out and passed on the first two plays. Like, oh, you should always pass on running situations.
I thought the play calling was shockingly pass heavy, right? Which, if you heard Pete Carroll on Monday, does not sound like that's going to be the case this next week.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Pete is right when he says that they didn't pass more because they didn't pick up, or they didn't run more because they didn't pick up first downs. Which, it's true that they would have run more, partially because they would have just run more plays.
Right.
And they didn't get a chance to get in rhythm running the ball or whatever that means, just because they were so bad on third down. And really, that's the reason that they didn't run the ball more times. It doesn't mean that they would have been more successful had they run more.
That is probably true.
But I was impressed with how much they came out to pass, and it looked less like the offense we feared that the Seahawks would have, where it's just pound the ball, third and long, Dixon punt. Here it was, pass the ball, incomplete, short gain running the ball, incomplete pass, Dixon punt. It was slightly different, and I like throwing the ball down the field. I like that they're throwing a lot of deep passes under the Schottenheimer regime, and the touchdown to Lockett was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very positive part of the Seahawks offense in their heyday, was their ability to, you know, make those red line throws down the field. And we saw that show up again. By the way, I have finally found this Earl Thomas stat. The success rate for Denver's offense was 70% of their plays when he was off the field, 47% when he was on the field, and their expected points allowed per play was plus 0.91 for the Broncos when he was off the field and minus 0.17 when he was on the field, including, of course, the interception from Earl.
So how can the Seahawks look at this and not want to extend Earl Thomas?
I mean, you know, I'm sure their argument would be, again, the risk of injuries when you give an aging player a long-term contract, and the fact that the Earl you see today is not necessarily the Earl you're going to see at the end of a new contract. You know, they're not paying him for his production now. They're paying him for his production in several years. Now, all that being said, pay this man.
Like,
pay Earl. Like, the team is nothing without him. It's just Michael Dixon and Russell Wilson. That's all it is.
I mean, that's pretty much true.
You got left speechless by that.
A lot of what we saw on Sunday, and I didn't see that much from Michael Bennett on Thursday night, but a lot of what we saw on Sunday was things that seemed obvious to, I feel like, many fans over the offseason. Like, extend Earl Thomas. He's very valuable. Rashad Penny was not worth a first-round pick.
Which you don't want to draw conclusions about after one game. But
I mean, he could not be worth a first-round pick, basically. Like, he'd have to be like a once-in-a-generation running back to be worth a first-round pick. But also, on the Vikings, Sheldon Richardson, looking like a beast out there, only getting paid $8 million a year.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the issues that I feel like we have, which are not... It's just understanding how to allocate assets, basically.
Yes.
And I think that they've had a very hard time. And I think early in the Pete and John regime, they were pretty good at this. And they knew where to spend money and where to let people go. And
they're
maybe a little over-aggressive with, like, the Harvin trade.
Well, what you would say is that those decisions were easier for them to make because of the fact that they didn't have to make hard choices, because Richard Sherman was making nothing. Cam Chancellor was making nothing. Russell Wilson was making nothing. Like, when you have that many good players making that little money,
yes,
you don't have to make hard decisions about where you're going to allocate money. It's okay that you're paying Zach Miller as much as they were at one period of time, or, you know... Chris Clemens deal or whatever the contract
may
be.
So you're saying that they didn't have to make hard decisions about where to allocate the money in the cap,
yeah,
because saying, players were making so little.
I'm saying those covered a multitude of sins. And right now the Seahawks don't have that luxury, because if you look at players who are dramatically underpaid on the Seahawks, I mean, maybe Chris Carson, even though running backs don't get paid that much. Michael Dixon obviously is
vastly,
substantially underpaid, would be worth hundreds of millions on the open market if he ever were allowed to get there. And Russell Wilson is probably underpaid at this point, you know, relative to where the quarterback at market is going.
I mean, since he signed Will Disley is severely underpaid.
Okay, yeah, we'll cut the thrill.
That's what I was talking about this entire time.
Oh, okay.
No, that's an interesting thought, though, is that they basically have no players who are. Their value is exceeding their contract.
I mean, they don't have no players, but they don't have players who are doing it as dramatic. Like, it's not that the current situation is that unusual. They're probably on the low end of it, but it's just that the situation they were in before was historically rare, which is why they were set up for a multi-year run of Super Bowl contention that resulted in one Super Bowl.
Well, and the problem is, I feel like we're going to be living Super in the past all season long, but... Because there were such baffling moves.
You're living in the future because you're just so excited to see Shaquem Griffin and Trey Flowers out there.
Hey, Trey Flowers played well.
Twitter did not suggest to me that he played well. Again, I didn't see, so I can't judge for myself.
I was the only person in the building who thought Trey Flowers, but no, he had some good plays.
It was interesting with Griffin that it evolved kind of as the game went on, that he played exclusively on passing downs.
It did appear that he was benched, and you don't know how much of that after hearing Pete Carroll talking about players vomiting on the sideline from the altitude.
No, I mean, clearly the way they went with the rotation, I think, was, you know, a reflection of the fact that they don't think he's effective a run defender, a base defender at this point.
Sure.
Which is understandable.
But I think the big error that happened, was that in the run game? I think that might have been on the Lindsay touchdown. But it's just that these things seem so obvious, and the places that they allocated money don't make sense and didn't have the same kind of production. Although Tyler Lockett with a nice play.
Yeah.
So, and now all of a sudden Tyler Lockett better perform because...
Doug Baldwin ain't walking through that door the next couple of weeks. And if he does, he's going to be limping because he's got injuries to both knees now.
God. But you know who is walking through that door? Keenan Reynolds. I'm the only one who's excited about this.
I mean, Keenan Reynolds, he seemed promising during the preseason.
No, it was just tough to watch throughout the game, seeing the Broncos have like, at one point it was like, the Broncos have 19 receptions to their wide receivers for like 200 yards. And the Seahawks have, this was before the Lockett touchdown, like 3 receptions to their receivers for like 8 yards.
Now this is partially because the thrill was accumulating so much yardage. I mean, Brandon Marshall also,
earlier in the game. In the fourth quarter, they got the ball to wide receivers a little bit more.
Pretty quiet game for Jerron Brown, 1 catch and 3 targets for 7 yards. Like to see more from him going forward.
Eventually, Marshall got it going and got the touchdown. I didn't think it was OPI on the play.
Thought it was OPI, so.
Brandon Marshall did?
Yeah, he said after the game it was the right call. You didn't see that?
No.
Yeah.
It's bullshit. What does he know?
Yeah. Could he even see what was happening on the play?
Refs are obscuring it. Anyway, this felt very different than last year where we came out of week one with feeling like, you know what, the Seahawks could have, without these interesting decisions by referees, won this game. And they played to the same level, we felt like, as the Packers in Green Bay.
Yeah.
This was the Seahawks...
Didn't play to the same level as Denver?
Didn't play to the same level as Denver. I mean, it's a documented hard place to play. That's the thing, is you can't just look at it and say, this is Denver, they were a bad team last year.
But when you look at the totality of everything that happened, the fact that this was a winnable, if difficult, because of the location game for them on the road, the fact that Doug Baldwin is injured, the fact that they did not perform well on a per-play basis, I think all of that points to now the expectation for the Seahawks is below 500.
Okay.
I mean, Football Outsiders projections have them at like 7.5 wins, which is down from where it was before the start of the season.
I mean, I'm not going to dispute that. That's the way that I feel also. It's like...
I think the other thing it does is it makes Monday night an extraordinarily crucial game for them not to get off to an 0-2 start.
Kind of a must-win game in week two.
Yeah. And an interesting matchup against the Chicago team that came out under first-year head coach Matt Nagy displaying a really creative offense, taking advantage of the fact that they have 2 great running back talents to the extent that exists in Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen, and using both of them together in the backfield at times. I hope that UW was taking some notes on how they used Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen, and you know, maybe do the same with Savon Ahmed and Miles Gaskin.
I think just Jake was taking notes from Mitch Trubisky.
Oh, no. And then, you know, making simple reads for Mitch Trubisky, allowing him to kind of throw to his first read, plays where he doesn't have to make complex decisions, open receivers. And he started out against Green Bay 7 of 7 for 104 yards as the Bears were marching up and down the field. And then with Aaron Rodgers leaving with an apparent knee injury, it looked like a new era for Chicago was going to start off with a huge road win against their arch rivals. And then Aaron Rodgers came back in the game. And things changed dramatically from that point. Over his final 28 pass attempts, Mitch Trubisky, 16 of 28 for 67 yards. That's 4.2 yards per completion and 2.4 yards per attempt in that span. That is like shockingly bad.
So do you think that they spent the entire offseason working on those first 7 plays? And then they ran out of those and they're like, oh, crap.
Well, I think it was about 15. They didn't throw on all 7 of them. But it was interesting because it was the scripted portion and it was a bunch of looks that Chicago clearly hadn't shown in the preseason. Green Bay wasn't necessarily prepared for. And that's one of the things that's going to be really fascinating to see how the Seahawks defense does against the Chicago offense in this game with a week's worth of game film to watch and a week to prepare for it. 8 days even to prepare for it. So I'm very curious about that. And then also to see how the Chicago defense holds up, because they looked great in the first half, even when Rodgers was on the field. He wasn't able to get anything going in the early part of this game. But the second half, you saw them wear down Khalil Mack, who just wreaked havoc in his Chicago debut in the first half,
kind of a non-factor in the second half. Not too surprising given that he didn't practice at all during training camp because of his holdout. Also saw that to some extent with Roquan Smith, their first-round pick, who also missed a lot of time in training camp because he had a contract dispute at the start and then had a hamstring injury that slowed him. And all of a sudden, Aaron Rodgers, despite his lack of mobility, was able to, you know, get the ball out quickly, find wide receivers, and those wide receivers were able to make big plays, most notably the Randall Cobb 81-yard touchdown that ended up winning this game.
Somebody needs to tell Shoddy about getting the ball out quickly.
Or 75-yard touchdown, I should say. Yeah, that's a thing you're allowed to do in the NFL, as it turns out.
Even on third down, no less. You know, I saw the last series for Trubisky where they're driving downfield trying to get a point.
There was a moment where it looked like, okay, this is going to happen, and then it didn't.
Well, he drew the roughing, not he didn't try it. He got pushed over by Clay Matthews and got the late hit penalty in 15 yards. And I think they completed a pass after that, and then it was just like full on deer in the headlights. Like there was no, I had no confidence cheering. I was cheering for the Bears in this moment. No confidence that Trubisky was going to complete another pass.
Yeah,
it felt like it would have been a miracle had he completed another pass at that point. Like those balls were all over the place. It was some of the worst quarterbacking that I saw all week.
So you talked about the Seahawks for a long period of time, struggling to get the wide receivers involved. 19 of the 35 targets for Trubisky in that opener were to running backs or tight ends. Allen Robinson, the marquee addition over the offseason, to get 7 targets. He had 4 catches on those for 61 yards. On the other side, they also brought in Taylor Gabriel, who averaged 16.5 yards per catch in 2016 with the Falcons as their big deep play threat. Atlanta went to the Super Bowl and lost that year. Then 11.5 yards per catch last year. This year, in his debut for the Bears, he had 5 catches on as many targets, but they went for an average of 5 yards per catch for a total of 25 yards. And then their other addition over the offseason was Trey, don't call me Seth Burton, at tight end.
He was get this joke.
Well, I called him Seth Burton back when we were talking about Seahawks free agency back in March.
Oh, did you?
I did. He had 6 targets, caught 1 of them for 15 yards. So,
and yeah. Fantasy owners were very upset about it. So Matt Nagy comes from the Andy Reid school of coaching, and you can kind of see what they're trying to do. It's just that when you look at, say, Pat Mahomes on one side, somebody, or even Alex Smith, who's a pretty, like, still, I think Alex Smith is an amazing quarterback at everything. Love Alex Smith. But able to get the ball downfield if he needs to.
Yes.
Mitchell Trubisky is not able to do that.
That doesn't seem so at this stage of his career.
I mean, they've got players who could hypothetically be deep threats, but they do not have the quarterback who's able to deliver it to them.
Yeah, and don't necessarily have those under... I mean, I guess Burton is that guy, but the underneath threats that you'd really want with a younger quarterback who's struggling to get the ball downfield. But the benefit that they have with Trubisky is the strength of this running game, which was number 2 in rushing DVOA last week. 60% of Jordan Howard's rushes were successful. And then Trubisky was also a contributor to that himself with 7 carries for 32 yards, including one play on a third down where they basically just brought him out on a sweep with, I think, the running back as the lead blocker, if I recall correctly, and he picked up like a 3rd and 3 on that one for a first down. So that'll be something to watch for the Seahawks defense.
So it's going to be hard. It's not going to be hard to tell. It was hard to tell in week 1 how much the rushing success was the Seahawks' run defense is bad versus the altitude plus the heat, kind of everything that's not going to be happening in Chicago on Monday night.
And the Seahawks did end up average in terms of rushing DVOA against them, despite their relatively high yards per carry.
No, and we would take a running play most of the game.
Yeah. I mean, this week is probably, the Bears are the one team that actually probably should run more. That they're it. They're the exception.
They ran a lot.
They may still have needed to run a little bit more, particularly on that 3rd and 1 where they ended up, there was an incompletion. They ended up kicking the field goal to go up 6 before the Randall Cobb touchdown. In that situation, Green Bay was out of timeouts, so the clock was going to run if they ran. Like, worst case scenario, you take 40 seconds off the clock. It didn't end up mattering because of the fact that the Packers scored that 75-yard touchdown so quickly before, I think, the 2-minute warning even. Yeah, it was a weird game, man. Aaron Rodgers. Glad we're not going to Green Bay this year. On the other side of the football,
The Bears defense ended up 13th in DVOA in the first week. As I mentioned, kind of a tale of two halves. Green Bay wide receivers had a big game and some questions about that secondary and the safety group, particularly, I would say. 19 catches and 26 targets for those wide receivers for 299 yards, including touchdowns of the aforementioned 75 for Randall Cobb and 39 for Geronimo Allison, plus a 51-yard non-touchdown to Devontae Adams, who hauled in a shorter touchdown elsewhere in this game. Mack, in his first half, had a sack, an interception, and forced and recovered a fumble when Von Miller style, he just ripped the ball away from Deshaun Kizer. That was pretty impressive. The last player to do that was him.
Yeah.
Back in Oakland. I may have been wrong about like the impact of a star defensive player changing teams, but at the same time they did lose the game.
I mean they lost in Green Bay. Like the threshold's pretty high there.
True. And
it's a pretty high standard that you're holding them to.
He was only played 70% of snaps coming back from that holdout. Still had six pressures in this game, according to ESPN stats and info charting. And that's good because it's not like the Seahawks offensive line has any history of struggling with allowing pressure.
That's going to be bad.
I mean, you know the optimistic view.
What is the optimistic
view? The Seahawks don't have to face Khalil Mack when they play the Raiders in London.
There we go.
There you go.
He's not getting traded back.
It seems that I think that bridge has been burned. Chicago actually ended up better in this game defensively against the run than the pass. They were fifth in opponent rushing in defensive rushing DVOAs compared to 19th in passing DVOA.
Good to know that the Seahawks are going to pound the ball against them this week.
Green Bay running backs had 17 carries for 54 yards, an average of 3.2 yards per carry. I thought one thing that was interesting from the Seahawks is, and again, not having watched the game, just looking at the box score, is the fact that Russell Wilson was not really involved at all as a runner in this game. Two carries for 5 yards.
Yeah, and I'm a teensy bit worried about Russell Wilson.
Like his health?
No, not his health, just his
whether he's as spry as he used to
yes,
be?
Yes, his step. There was a play where he was rolling out, where I think he, I can't remember what happened on the play. I think he threw it or something, but he just didn't look fast.
Okay.
He didn't look like he was able to beat people like he was able to in the past. And there are some plays where I think this was noted maybe by Vince Verhey also, where the only time there was a 22-yard loss for a sack loss was last year was Russell Wilson also.
I mean, yes. Most like, quarterbacks doesn't have a tendency to like spin around and run backwards when they're pressured.
If Russell Wilson loses almost any step, he's going to have to adjust slightly.
That is true.
You know, and there were moments, like, I thought Russell played a pretty good game overall. It wasn't bad. The pick was kind of bad, the first pick that he had.
QBR was not that impressed by his performance. I think you finished with like a 44.
It was a fine game. It was a fine Russell Wilson game.
I feel like a fine game should be like a 60 QBR for us.
Okay, fine. Russell Wilson's the worst.
I'm just saying that. I'm just saying.
10th to 15th best quarterback in the league.
by the high standards he has set, this was not a good Russell Wilson.
I am saying that I'm a teensy bit concerned about Russell Wilson going forward, though.
Oh, good, because the Seahawks have so much else going for them on offense.
Just losing that element. I'm not saying that he has. Russell Wilson will evade defenders this season. He'll make big plays. This was an incredibly difficult place to play. They've won 12 straight games at home in September. Like, honestly, it was
although some of those
matchup.
Were when they were a much better team than they are now.
Sure, but some of those were last year.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Right? Who did they beat last year?
I don't know, but I feel like Simeon started the season actually surprisingly well and then kind of melted down. They lost at Buffalo in September. I know because I was in Denver watching that game.
They were not that good of a team the last two seasons.
No.
And they still won all of their home games in September.
They started off very strong.
So this was an incredibly difficult matchup. It's unfortunate that the Seahawks had to do it and that they had to go there in September. And you look at it and you're like, okay, the Rams have to play the Raiders in their home opener. You know, next week they get the Cardinals.
They still have to play 16 games. They still played basically the same
schedule.
When
these games happen matters, though. When do they go to Denver? Do they go to Denver in September?
I mean, someone's got to go to Denver in September.
It just feels like it's always us. It's like week one, mathematically, we have to go at Green Bay.
Seahawks haven't played at Denver in 8 years.
It's always us playing the hardest games, though.
Don't you think that's probably a case of selective remembering?
No. I mean, I was saying to you that the Seahawks basically never start the season at home. We could think of two times in the Russell era. And one of those, they had to do it because we won the Super Bowl.
That is true.
And then the other time, the home opener, Russell Wilson got stepped on and basically ruined the entire season.
It did.
So that was fun. Anyway, it was an incredibly tough place to go.
Can you stop pounding the table so much?
there's part of us that we don't know what the team means after this. It was not a good performance, though.
No. In terms of special teams, Chicago is sixth in DVOA after week one. Particularly notable that Tariq Cohen had a 42-yard punt return in this game. The Seahawks were 12th, and that is almost exclusively thanks to Michael Dixon. They were average or worse in every other category but punting. Chances of victory.
Versus Rams, 24-21. This is the Broncos last year at home. Versus Rams, 24-21 in week one.
Okay,
versus Dallas, 42-17.
All right, that's
against a 9-7 team. Okay. Right? And then they beat Oakland, or that was October, so that doesn't count. October 1st. Yeah. Doesn't count.
It's totally different once you turn that clock.
This is a team that in the middle of the season lost 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 games in a row. Including at the Los Angeles Chargers, 21-0. I mean, hosting the Cowboys and beating them 42-17 last year is not easy.
Yeah.
And then in 2000, I have to look this up, because they were not a good team in 2016 either, right? Week one, hosting Carolina, beat them only 21-20. And then in week two, beat Indianapolis 34-20. How many? They were not a bad team that year, actually. They were 8-8 that year. So, but that's still beating at least one pretty good team in the home opener.
Yeah.
So I'm saying that maybe the team looked bad. I've rationalized myself all the way to the other side.
That Tristan rationalizes something
good right away, and then I felt bad as I was like, I read Football Outsiders today, and I was like, this team sucks. I just like read all these stats, and I was like, this is a bad football team. What am I doing? I went and looked at the box score. I was like, this is a bad team, and now I'm out the other side.
We're through the looking glass here.
I still think the chances of victory are somewhere around 40%, though.
Yeah, I was gonna go 40.
Okay. I don't know how the Seahawks are going to lose to Mitchell Trubisky, but it's going to happen. Somehow they're going to lose to Mitch Trubisky. And if they make him look good, it's panic time for the defense.
That's probably true.
It's full on just trade Earl for whatever you can get at this point, because he's going to leave time.
Hopefully the Cowboys win next week.
We've got a lot of complicated things that we're cheering for right now. But Trubisky does not look like, he looks like a bottom five quarterback in the NFL.
Yep.
Whew. All right.
Should we go get into what I like to call the facilities segment of this week's podcast?
Okay.
Because there's a lot of facilities talk going on in the city of Seattle and in King County right now. Let's start with the Key Arena rebuild. Last week, the NHL Seattle Group announced agreement with the city on transaction documents related to the Key Arena rebuild that were necessary before the final approval of that deal. Also announced local minority investors will be part of the NHL ownership group, highlighted by the Ackerley brothers, the sons of former Sonics owner Barry Ackerley, Sounders FC majority owner Adrian Hanauer, Amazon Web Services CEO Andy Jassy, the Wright brothers, who are part of the family that owns and operates the Space Needle, and whose father, Howard, was part of the original Sounders and Seahawks ownership groups. And one of them, David Wright, will serve as vice chairman of the team. And then lastly, Jay Deutsch of local sports marketing agency BDA. So a number of prominent local figures, I would say, that reinforce kind of the local ties from this ownership group.
It was something that they kind of had to do.
Yeah, I mean, you said it was expected, but I still think they came up with a really strong group. And clearly, you see Tim Leiwicki's, or I should say Todd Leiwicki's, ties to the local community here. He'd like served on boards with the Wright brothers. Adrian Hanauer, of course, the Seahawks were originally investors in Sounders FC when they were getting off the ground as an expansion franchise. So he was really able to call in, I think, a lot of those connections. Also, I want to note here the irony of the Ackerley brothers being part of a group bringing NHL to Seattle when Key Arena was originally designed so that it could not host an NHL
ice rink. Yeah, that's a baffling one. How many of these people have goodwill in the city of Seattle?
I think most of them do.
Hanauer.
Definitely. People feel positive about the Space Needle. I don't know that I was familiar with Andy Jassy before this news.
I wonder which business owners in the city of Seattle have that much goodwill anyway, like of any of them.
Right.
So. Sure.
Yeah, perhaps not.
Gotta get the Takas Chukis owners in there.
All right, so.
If they announced that would be part of the arena that I'm in, that's what it takes.
Changing your tune. At a city council briefing on Friday, the city of Seattle's lead negotiator on those transaction documents, Marshall Foster, shared that the deal now specifies no demolition will be allowed until after the NHL grants Seattle an expansion franchise. The NHL Seattle Group's presentation to league owners is scheduled for the October 2nd Board of Governors meeting, with a vote possible and probably expected, I would say, in December. And that would be about the timeline where you would typically want to start demolition anyway. So that's, I think, why the NHL Seattle Ownership Group is willing to sign off on that. Also notable, the Seattle City Council's Committee for Civic Arenas, Select Committee for Civic Arenas, is expected to vote on the transaction documents this Friday, followed by a full council vote on September 24th, which will probably be broadly similar, as that select committee has included all the members of the council. Lastly, on this front, NHL Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly gave us a bit of a surprise last week by telling ESPN's Emily Kaplan that the expansion timeline was, quote, more likely the 2021-22 season than the 2020-21 season, so we have some time. We've had that discussion on a preliminary basis with the ownership group, and I think the ownership group is on board with that timeline. That's not set in stone, but I don't think either side is feeling any time pressure. So this is interesting because of the fact that, you know, NHL Seattle was a presenting sponsor of the Storm games in the finals, and then also I think in the semifinal, one of the games in the semifinals, and we're giving out rally towels that still say NHL 2020. They're still using that is their slogan, but all of a sudden Bill Daly is suggesting that 2021 might be the more likely outcome.
I mean, that's when it's happening. Look, they're not pressuring the NHL here. It's the NHL's decision.
It is, and, you know,
if they want it to happen, when he's saying this, he means it's happening in 2021, 22.
I mean, he definitely left the door very open as to it happening in 2020, but, you know, it accomplishes a couple of things. Number one, it puts less pressure on the arena construction to be completed by October 2020, which would be a tight timetable, although obviously it's the one that the organization, that Oakview and the NHL Seattle Group have been working towards. Number two, which I didn't really realize until this got discussed last week, is it also might mitigate the possibility that the start of the franchise is delayed by a work stoppage in the NHL. So either the NHL owners or the Players Association can decide by next September to opt out of their current collective bargaining agreement, and then that would be opened in the summer of 2020, creating the potential for a work stoppage then that might last into the season.
What do you think the chances are of that actually happening?
I mean, the track record of the NHL negotiations is that prolonged lockouts tend to be the case.
Man, because they've been pretty affected as a league by these lockouts.
Yeah, I mean, they missed an entire season. No other league has done that, so the most recent time that was not the case, but there was some time missed. And that's, I think, one possible consideration here.
It's a little bit different than the NBA, though, who's come back even stronger since their lockout. Or,
I mean, I think the NHL is in a pretty good place right now, financially, all things considered.
So you don't want to fuck it up.
The suggestion, I read a piece today on The Athletic by Pierre LeBrun, who suggested that at this point it would be now the players who are more likely to want to revisit the CBA than the owners. But the other aspect of that is, you know, if there's not that same appetite for an extended work stoppage among the owners, then they may be able to work things out ahead of time and not have it come to that point. All right, continuing on the facilities department of the podcast, The King County Council Committee approved a 5-4 compromise proposal last week that directs $135 million in public funding to Safeco Field maintenance. You'll recall that the Mariners had requested $180 million for Safeco Field, but their general counsel, Fred Rivera, said that that should be enough for the M's to sign the 25-year lease they had previously agreed to with the public facilities district that controls Safeco Field. This is technically subject to the vote of full council, but given that all 9 members voted as part of this committee, you'd assume that it would be the same 5-4 outcome. It is also subject to a possible public referendum by petition, and we'll keep an eye on that. The council is part of this compromise.
A public referendum for this not to happen?
To put it to a public vote.
Oh.
Yeah. So we'll see.
Within King County?
Yes.
Oh, man. Let's make that happen. Where's Tim Iman when you need him? So angry.
Anyone else? The council, as part of this compromise, increased funding for affordable housing by $160 million. Now, you might be doing some math here and be like, wait a second, the Mariners got $45 million less. How can they increase it by $160 million? And the answer is that the remaining $115 million will come from funds initially scheduled to go to tourism promotion. A good piece by Mike Baker in the Seattle Times on this kind of broke that down.
Now nobody's going to visit Seattle if there isn't that kind of tourism promotion.
People did express that concern. I feel like I'm pretty skeptical about the value of those, like, come visit Seattle commercials.
Well, we have a lot of Canadians come to visit Seattle during Mariners games.
That's true.
So I think that's working, maybe.
That is an excellent point.
Oh, my God. I mean, I suppose this is something, but, like, the what they did to have that money go to affordable housing, the increased $160 million go to affordable housing is good, but also even more of this Mariners money could have gone there.
Yes.
It doesn't mean, like,
there's not like a maximum. Yeah, no.
Look,
not.
You can't spend too much money on tourism.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have, who knows what the tourism budget is now. It's funny because you see those, like, billboards every once in a while that are like, visit Baltimore. And you're like, what? Who? What?
Baltimore?
No, I've seen Baltimore billboards.
I've never seen Baltimore. I mean, they have the Portland commercials. Those are more effective because I might reasonably go and visit Portland.
There are ones that are much farther away than Portland.
No, I know that. I'm not disputing that. I just don't recall Baltimore specifically.
Pretty sure it's Baltimore.
The fact that I can't come up with a specific city off the top of my head tells me how ineffective they are.
I'm just like, why would I go there?
But it's just like, I'm also aware that this city exists. You don't need to tell me. Like, it's not like Seattle is an obscure city. Well, it's very prominent.
It's also just used to, like, promote stereotypes about the city. It's like a big cartoon ad with some salmon on it or whatever. Like, it's not like people are learning more about it. Everybody knows that Seattle is a big cartoon ad with a salmon on it and, like, a cup of coffee in Mount Rainier. It's like you're just reinforcing the, like, 3 things that every person knows about Seattle.
You forgot grunge.
There's a flannel. The Baltimore thing probably had like a crab cake or something.
Sounds about right.
Anyway, more of this money, the $135 million more of this money could have gone to affordable housing.
It's true. It's all true.
They could have actually spent $0 on Safeco Field renovations or upkeep or whatever it's going to.
Upkeep, yes. And maintenance. The Mariners now 8.5 back of the A's. With, I believe, I'm doing the math off the top of my head here, 18 games to play. I'm starting to think it's not going to happen. God,
this is so good.
You know what the thing is? They might not even win the third wild card at this point because Tampa Bay has pulled even with them in the standings for the third wild card.
There are literally no Mariners fans left on the face of the earth either. There were so many of them in July, and now they don't exist.
Well, sadly, because of the fact that the Sounders were off due to the international break, and a toast, by the way, to the U.S. beating Mexico 1-0. How about
nice.
That? A rare positive result from the USMNT meant that they could not improve their playoff odds while the Mariners were dwindling, as had been the case most of the year. But we'll have another opportunity to do so this Saturday, traveling up north up I-5 for a derby match against the Vancouver Whitecaps on Saturday night. Notably,
with Baltimore.
Notably, Chad Marshall will be available for this game. He was sent off with a red card late in their most recent win over Sporting Kansas City, but that suspension was rescinded by the independent panel. So he will be available to play. Vancouver comes into this one 1 point back of the Sounders for the sixth and final playoff spot in the Western Conference. Sounders do have a match in hand against the Whitecaps, but notably, the Whitecaps have the sixth lowest rating in MLS in 538 Soccer Power Index. They have a -7 goal differential as compared to +8 for the Sounders. Vancouver does come in hot. They haven't lost since a 2-0 loss in Seattle on July 21st. They are 4-2-0 since then and boast a potent attack led by Kai Kamara's 11 goals in his first season in Vancouver.
A huge match.
Yeah.
In the Derby.
A pivotal match.
Every match is a Derby match now. I see no reason why the Sounders couldn't keep the win streak going, though.
I mean, it'll be a tough one, but I mean, they are the better team, but home, probably not enough so to be the favorites given home field. So it'll be perhaps the toughest test in a while of the 8-match winning streak for the Sounders, the record 8-match winning streak. We're also pouring one out this week for Ziggy Schmidt, who resigned as head coach of the LA Galaxy on Monday, who are slumping right now, including a loss to the Sounders recently. And then the other bit of Sounders news, S2. Their minor league team in the USL announced that they are rebranding with a new name for Tacoma and soliciting your name suggestions.
So they're not going to be S2 anymore. I thought they played at Starfire anyway. So maybe
they moved to Tacoma this year.
Okay.
Now, that's why they've decided to change. And they're going to play at a new stadium next to Cheney Stadium.
It's probably a good call to rebrand, though.
Yeah.
And not just be kind of like under the Sounders umbrella.
Especially now that they're in a separate city and you want to kind of reflect the identity of Tacoma. Mm-hmm. As one does. In unfortunate soccer news, the Seattle Reign lost 3-1 at Portland on Friday, which means that the Thorns will now be hosting the semifinal matchup between these two teams when they meet again on Saturday in one of two NWSL semifinals at 12 noon on Lifetime. The Reign scored first through Jess Fishlock in the fourth minute. Portland equalized in the 30th minute, took the lead just after halftime, and added an insurance goal in the 82nd minute. The Reign played this one without Megan Rapinoe due to rib soreness that's kept her out lately, and Allie Long due to a knee sprain. We'll see with the 8 days off, they can get back in the lineup in time for this crucial semifinal matchup for the Reign, their first playoff appearance in a few years here. I think 3 years. We close this week with Husky football, who had probably the most disappointing 45-3 win in program history on Saturday against North Dakota.
It's really a good place to be.
Is it?
It's a good place to be.
Where you have a quarterback crisis after a 45-3 win against North Dakota. FCS North Dakota, who managed to keep things close through three quarters, had actually outrushed the Huskies through that point.
Really?
145-79 through the first three quarters before the UW ground attack got going in the fourth quarter as they pulled away, scored touchdowns on three consecutive possessions at one point to produce the lopsided final margin.
So I didn't see basically any of this game.
We're in opposite positions now.
How much of this had to do with their offensive line?
Okay, so, I mean, I think it was a combination of things. So, first off, since we last talked, we learned that Trey Adams indicated via Instagram that he underwent back surgery last week. Adam Jude of the Seattle Times reported that he will miss the entire season. Don't yet have confirmation of that. And then also starting center Nick Harris missed this game due to a minor injury. He's still atop the depth chart. Doesn't seem like a long-term concern, but was replaced by Jesse Sosabe, who is making his first career start. That left three Husky offensive linemen with a combined two career starts between them.
Insane.
When you count Jared Hilbers replacing Adams at left tackle and then Jackson Kirkland at right guard. You talked before the season about how excited you were about the Huskies' experience on the offensive line, and all of a sudden that has been...
It fell apart in 1 week.
It de-escalated quickly.
Okay, so...
So that's a part of it. And they struggled to really run the ball straight ahead against North Dakota, very similar to what they had against Auburn. Of course, it makes a lot more sense that you would struggle to run the ball straight ahead against Auburn rather than North Dakota. I mean, the other thing that came into play here is North Dakota clearly decided... We're not scared of the Huskies' passing attack. We're going to load up in the box against the run and dare you to beat us over the top. And Jake Browning was unable to do so in this game, despite an impressive-looking line. When you look at kind of his raw numbers, he threw for over 300 yards, but he had a couple of interceptions. And when you consider kind of the context of both the opposition and the way that they were loading the box against the run, it was a disappointing performance and one that has led to renewed calls for a quarterback change at UW, despite the fact that Jake Browning is the most accomplished quarterback in the history of the program. You gonna say anything here?
I didn't see this, so it's hard for me to say anything because I don't really know what happened. But listening to the game on the radio occasionally, it just didn't feel like the offense was moving like it should.
It wasn't. No, I mean they scored 17 points deep in had scored 17 points deep into the third quarter.
Was this Jake Browning's fault?
I mean, again, it was a combination of things, but the fact that the fact that the run, like, it was a more favorable situation for Jake Browning than it was for the rushing game.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying to you.
Nobody is, like, calling for Miles Gaskin to be benched.
No.
Except for me forever, for Savon Ahmed.
I mean, Ahmed may be more, like, to the extent that the Huskies have had success running the ball through 2 weeks, it's been almost exclusively to the perimeter, and that is more Ahmed's game than Miles Gaskin's game.
Four carries for 44 yards.
And I would like to, I mean, 34 of those came on one carry. I would like to see more of Ahmed, but not necessarily, that's not like he should start. As I said earlier, I want to see Ahmed and Gaskin together.
Yeah.
I want to see both of them on the field and present that kind of multiple threat.
Right. We're not asking for Ahmed vis-a-vis Miles Gaskin.
It's not a criticism of Miles Gaskin, who also is the all-time leading rusher in program history.
I am asking for the Wildcat to go away forever.
Really?
Oh, God, I hate the Wildcat.
I mean, the way the Brownie was throwing the ball wasn't maybe the worst idea on Saturday.
Oh, man. Here's what I like. I like the Wildcat with the three running backs on the field.
Kamari Pleasant,
yeah.
Also, or McGrew?
Yeah. I want basically the triple option Wildcat, and I would like an option to throw in there, too.
Okay. All right. If you say so.
I'm asking for a quarterback.
So you're asking for Russell Wilson to play quarterback for the Huskies.
Russell Wilson like 6 years ago.
I asked Ben B last week on this very pod whether we needed to have the Jake Browning discussion. And he was like, no, they narrowly lost on the road, you know, effectively on the road to a top 10 team. It's not a thing anymore. But it turns out that it very much is a thing. And particularly after Jake Haener came in and in garbage time of this game went 7 of 7 for 110 yards and a touchdown, including a couple of nice hookups with Ty Jones. And that kind of accelerated the calls for Jake Haener to take over at quarterback, despite the fact that he had never taken the field in a college football game before last Saturday.
How do you feel about this?
I mean, it's insane with one important caveat. So part of what happened in this game is that Jake Browning showed up for the game wearing a giant knee brace on his right knee. And at one point at the end of the third quarter, I think that was after he scrambled for a first down, he limped off and like had to adjust the knee brace. And it was unclear whether like the brace was what was causing him to limp or just he was limping because of the fact that his knee was hurt and the brace was not protecting him. It seems very plausible at this point that he is injured.
That Jake Browning's injured.
Yes. That's an important caveat here. I mean, if Russell Wilson turned up next week with a knee brace, like out of nowhere, can you imagine like the outcry if Pete Carroll didn't say anything about it? Like, first off, Adam Schefter would be on the case.
Yes.
Like, we would figure out what was happening.
We get Adam Jude here, not Adam Schefter.
Adam Jude does great work, but it's not, you know, a bunch of national reporters and all the local reporters chasing down this information. It's just the local reporters because there's not the same sort of degree of sourcing in college football with the number of programs as there is in the NFL. And there's also, we've just come to expect that other than maybe some serious long-term injuries, we're not going to hear anything about injuries from most college coaches, including Coach B.
This is insane.
So if Jake Browning is injured, then that changes everything.
When sports betting is fully legalized, will college football betting be fully legalized or whatever?
I mean, they can't prohibit it, but I don't think they're going to embrace it.
They're not going to be giving out injury reports because of gambling?
No.
Okay.
I think they're pretty anti-gambling. They've established that.
Another fun stance by college football.
I mean, I think the history of point shaving scandals in college sports is sufficient that they are right to be concerned about that possibility.
Maybe nobody's floated that Jake is point shaving. What was the line for this game?
Maybe someone. They did narrowly not cover the spread, as it turns out, but of course, that was mostly because of what they did in the first three quarters, rather, where you usually, if you're going to shave points, you do it at the end of the game, not at the start of the game.
That's but Jake, he knew he only had so much time.
Look, this was a bad game for Browning. His adjusted for opponent, his 43.0 QBR was the third worst of the last three seasons. Like, if you take out his freshman year, when obviously he was much less effective. He had two weaker performances last year at Arizona State in the Huskies' loss, and then at home against UCLA in a game where he only threw 11 pass attempts because the Huskies ran for approximately 900 yards in that game. And then the home game against Arizona State in 2016, when he was, in fact, we later learned, playing with a shoulder injury. His QBR against Auburn of 75.6, once you adjust for opponent, would have ranked 20th in FBS last season and was slightly better than the actual 71.9 QBR Browning finished with, which was good for 28th in the country. Now, an important question you have to ask yourself here is, if Jake Browning is healthy, what are the odds that Jake Haener is capable of being better than the 28th best quarterback in the country by QBR? They're not zero, but I feel pretty confident they're a lot less than 50%. And I don't think that seven throws in garbage time against North Dakota are going to change that. So, again, assuming he's healthy, Jake Browning should not be in the position where every single game, a game against an FCS opponent, is a referendum on his future as the starting quarterback. This is someone who owns all the passing records in Husky history, has taken the team to the New Year's Six back-to-back years. Like, nowhere else in the country would this even be a question other than UW.
I mean, Alabama did change their quarterback in the national championship game last
year. They did. Jalen Hurts did not own all of the Alabama passing records.
He'd played in the national championship game the previous year, I think.
He did.
So I don't know if I agree at that point. But yes.
Okay, fine. Maybe in Alabama it would be. This is not Alabama. Tui Tagovailoa, I have forgotten how to pronounce his last name in that last year. He's not walking through that door.
Oh, man. I wish he was. Okay. Well, what's going to happen this week when there is a referendum on Jake Browning?
Well, it's bad news because I would say it's not a good situation for Jake here because of the fact that they are playing a Utah team that is substantially better on defense than on offense, comes into this game ranked number one in ESPN's FPI efficiency in terms of defense. After
who have they played?
Well, you know, you might say, ain't played nobody, Paul. They played Weber State and then Northern Illinois in their first two games.
Okay.
And much like the Huskies, Utah comes into this concerned about their offense, which scored just 10 points against Northern Illinois last week. They were shut out in the first half, and the final 17-6 margin was provided by an interception return by linebacker Chase Hansen with 2:36 left, and the Huskies driving for what could have been at that point the go-ahead score.
The Northern Illinois Huskies?
Yes. Yes, those Huskies. The one who played Husky Stadium with an IE rather than a Y.
Do they really?
Yes.
They played Huskies.
So it could be another defensive struggle, I think, this weekend. It's a reasonable assumption.
This is going to be an interesting one.
It is. On Utah's side, junior quarterback Tyler Huntley ranks 11th in the Pac-12 in QBR so far at 34.6. So he's averaged over two games, substantially worse than Browning had last week when everyone was so upset about it. He has completed 63% of his passes for 7.7 yards per attempt, but has been sacked seven times in 78 dropbacks, which is even a little bit worse than last year's rate. And of course, when you consider the opposition, very disconcerting, was sacked six times by Northern Illinois. Running back Zach Moss had 150 yards in the opening win over Weber State, but had 16 carries for 66 yards, 4.1 yards per carry last week. No other Utah running back has more than four carries this season. And then in terms of the wide receiver core, Britton Covey has been the main target for Huntley. He had 8 catches for 129 yards last week and also has 3 carries this season for 67 yards. So watch for him on the end around, fly sweep, that sort of thing. Defensively, the aforementioned Chase Hansen, who had that game ceiling touchdown interception return for a touchdown last week, leads a defense that is just 16 points so far. He was named the Pac-12 Defensive Player of the Week after coming up with 12 tackles last week and also has 4.5 tackles for loss this season. He's played some at defensive back, so he's very athletic for a linebacker. Also, I think originally played quarterback when he came in, and maybe Utah should consider putting him back there. Well, lastly, special teams have been an issue for the Utes. Kicker Matt Gay is 3 of 6 on field goals and has had 2 of those blocked through 2 weeks.
I mean, these sound like line issues to me.
I think many of them are, yes.
I mean, you're talking about they have a very bad run game. Their quarterback's been sacked numerous times. They had 2 kicks blocked. This sounds like a very bad offensive line.
That would be a safe conclusion.
The one thing that people aren't talking about enough is that, I mean, granted, it's not hard, but this Husky defense after that first quarter against Auburn, maybe early in the game, has been very good.
Yeah.
And they're going to be playing against a team in Utah that's not going to be able to generate a lot of offense. Jake Browning is not going to have to do a ton in this game.
Hopefully, yeah.
Hopefully that's the case, yes. Jake Browning likely will not have to do a ton in this game. And if they can just be steady and efficient and get some kind of run game going, I think that they can come up with a comfortable victory here.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I thought that was really interesting that the Huskies were doing on defense, they rotated a fair bit in this game, as you'd sort of expect. They occasionally during this game were using Taylor Rapp essentially as a dime linebacker in pass situations. They had Brandon McKinney in there at safety, who played a few series in place of Rapp. And then, you know, we're walking Rapp up much closer to the line of scrimmage. He came up with 2 sacks in this game.
There we go.
It's kind of interesting. It's similar, maybe you'd say, to how Shaq Thompson, who was wearing the same number 7
Taylor
at that
Rapp's
point.
Be a first-round pick this year.
Well, we'll see about that.
You don't think so? Maybe just because of how people value safeties?
Yes. Maybe if they see him as a linebacker like Shaq Thompson, maybe that helps his case.
Yeah, it absolutely does.
Yeah. But I'm curious to see how much they use that alignment in this game and whether it's, you know, kind of a big part of the defense going forward.
That's interesting. I could see that being very terrifying for an offense.
Yeah.
Seeing Taylor Rapp right there.
You just don't know where he's going to be necessarily.
The main thing in this game will just be Jake not making mistakes.
Yeah, and that's, I think, you know, like, obviously a lot of the criticism of Browning historically has related to his arm strength, which to me is the most overvalued trait in a quarterback, other than, I guess, height and, you might say, skin tone.
God, have you seen some of these Pat Mahomes throws, though?
Oh, well, but Mahomes is accurate, too.
God.
I mean, yes.
Love him.
And that's why people fall in love with the strong-armed quarterback.
Having quarterback jealousy.
Seahawks are doing fine. Remain calm here. That's why people fall in love with these strong-armed quarterbacks. But, you know, there's maybe 1 out of every 10 throws that Jake Browning, his arm strength is an issue. And we saw one of those last week, you know, whether it was a case that he wasn't able to step into it because of the knee injury, or if he is in fact injured, or simply is just pure lack of arm strength. There was an out route that got jumped for an interception, one of his 2 interceptions. And that was one like, yeah, legitimately his arm strength was an issue on that play. But that's like maybe 3 passes a game we see that. And all the other passes.
If those 3 passes are intercepted, that's a big deal.
But they haven't been historically. His interception rate is very low.
No. Jake's fine. This is not an issue.
He might not be fine. But his lack of arm strength is not that big of an issue because there's 30 passes a game or whatever the number is where your accuracy comes into play, where your decision making comes into play. And those were not great for Jake Browning last week. But again, barring injury, I'm not going to read much into one game when we have 3+ years of him as a starter to understand that those are incredible strengths for Jake Browning.
For almost anybody. Okay, let me ask you this. What do you think it would take in this Utah game for Jake to be benched?
Assuming he's healthy?
I assuming he doesn't get injured during the game.
I mean, we don't know his health.
But if he's not currently healthy, then I think Chris Peterson's thinking may be entirely different. And it was interesting, it was pointed out after this game that, you know, they left in a lot of the first team receivers to play with Jake Haener, you know, building chemistry in case, you know, he is needed down the line. Now, you know, that could just be just you're being conservative and want to make sure that he's ready. But it also could be you have some thought that he need to be ready in the near future because of what you know about Jake Browning. But if he's healthy, I just don't think Chris Peterson is even considering it. And look, I don't want to appeal to authority here, but it's funny that like people, part of their argument for Jake Haener is like, oh, but the coaches said he had a great training camp. Like, okay, but the same coaches who said he had a great training camp also are the ones who are still playing Jake Browning. So how are you, who did not actually see him play in fall practice, knowing more about what he did than they do?
How good do we think Jake Haener is?
I mean, he's a black box. He's Schrodinger's quarterback. He could be good and he could be terrible. He looked very good on 7 passes. As I pointed out, KJ Carter-Samuels in a similar situation a couple years ago came in and went 6 for 7 for like 88 yards
yes.
in relief of Jake Browning during his sophomore year.
He was
year.
Successful in the easiest place to be successful ever.
Yeah.
Especially because they were still passing in that situation.
And it seemed like the North Dakota defense had substantially worn down by that point, which helped allow the Huskies to break off a bunch of long runs at that stage of the game.
So Jake Browning may have been able to do it too.
I think it's possible, yes.
No matter what, you stand with Jake.
I mean, that's the key. Well, I mean, there are a lot of Colson Yankoff fans out there. So I think that...
His name's not even Jake.
He's just got to change it legally.
I am so fascinated to see this game. I mean, it's always fun to watch games that matter and are exciting and could be close. But just from this standpoint, it is going to be very interesting.
I don't think that's fun at all. I don't remember that last Utah game being fun. I remember it being terrifying.
The other element that you have at play is...
I was actually thinking of 2 years ago, by the way. Although last year's Utah game was actually a lot of fun.
I don't really remember.
That was where they trailed the entire game and then came back to win.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that was actually maybe the most fun football game that we've ever been to. Save for the NFC Championship against the Packers. Well, the NFC Championships. Anyway, the other element you have at play is it's Pac-12 after dark.
It is.
You indeed. Have no idea what's going to happen out there. This is kind of the first Pac-12 after dark game. I mean, last week we had Arizona State against Michigan State, which was very Pac-12 after darky, but it wasn't two Pac-12 teams out there.
Pac-12-y after dark?
Pac-12-y after dark.
Yeah.
So, anything can happen in Pac-12 after dark. And that's a scary thing.
Yes. When you're the favorite, it's a scary thing.
Yes. What are the Huskies favored by?
6.5 points. And FPI gives them a 72% chance to win
this
week.
They just can't make mistakes. They can't get in their way in this game. At least it's not in the state of Arizona. That's all
yes.
I would say.
Yes, that is very true. And I do think there's an element to which the Huskies may be better off against a team like Utah that's kind of like another power team. Not that they're necessarily the most power team, but, you know, rather than a team that's like going to spread it out and wing it all over the field.
Yes. That's a much worse situation.
Chances of victory?
I think it's about 80%.
You think it's higher than FPI says?
What does FPI say?
72.
I really do. I think this is a good matchup.
I am concerned about Jake Browning's knee, so I'm going to go like 67.
I think Jake Haener is better anyway, so.
If
Jake Haener comes in and is better than Jake Browning like for the rest of the season or whatever, has an amazing rest of the season, oh, it'll make you so upset. And it's hard for me not to cheer for that. For me and Katie's sake. I mean, I want whomever to be good, but also it's like if Jake Haener comes in and is an amazing quarterback, like we'll be excited about it and you'll be upset about it. And me and Katie will really love that.
It'll only be a matter of time until they start complaining about Jake Haener too.
Then, I mean,
it's just never good enough.
When the next year's Jake is coming, it's already on the horizon.
It's true.
The Jake off is coming next year. Whew. Well, on that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.